This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to Washington Today. I'm Gary Starikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Here are some of your headlines. President Joe Biden hosted New York City's Democratic mayoral candidate and other city leaders at the White House today to talk about reducing gun violence. More on that in a minute. Drug manufacturer Pfizer met with top U.S. health officials today to discuss its request for federal authorization of a third dose of its coronavirus vaccine. The meeting comes as President Biden's chief medical advisor said that it is, quote, entirely conceivable, maybe likely, that booster shots will be needed for those who have already gotten COVID-19 vaccinations. Dr. Anthony Fauci talked about that today. We'll hear what he had to say later in the program. And the U.S. Senate returned to work today on Capitol Hill. The question that awaited them, will they or won't they pass an infrastructure bill? We'll hear from Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer and other Senate Republicans later in the program. It's all ahead here today on Washington Today. We'll start at the White House, where President Biden met with a group of city officials and law enforcement officers to talk about gun violence. Joining the president was Attorney General Merrick Garland, along with the police chiefs of Chicago, Memphis, and Newark, New Jersey. And Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, San Jose, California Mayor Sam Liccardo, and New York City mayoral candidate Eric Adams, who is a former police captain. The meeting comes amid increasing gun violence around the country while movements to reform policing continue and the president's own initiative aimed at enforcing federal gun trafficking laws. Here's President Biden speaking from the Roosevelt Room earlier.
The purpose of the meeting today is we've convened a group of law enforcement and other community leaders, including mayors of our cities. One, to thank them for their service, because we owe them big time. Second, hear directly from each of them about reducing violent crime, and particularly gun violence in their communities. Last month, I met with a similar group to unveil my comprehensive strategy to do just that. And it's been, I look at Attorney General, we've been at this a long time. Seems like most of my career I've been dealing with this issue. While there's no one-size-fit-all approach, we know there are some things that work. And the first of those that work is stemming the flow of firearms used to commit violent crimes. And we've talked, you and I have talked about this, Mayor, before. And it includes cracking down on holding rogue gun dealers accountable for violating the federal law. It includes the Justice Department creating five new strike forces to crack down on illegal gun trafficking, and the Carters supplying weapons to cities of New York, from New York to the Bay Area. Secondly, supporting local law enforcement with the federal support they need. Our strategy provides, including funding for law enforcement through the American Rescue Plan, for states, cities, and to be able to hire police and pay them overtime in order to advance community policing. Third, our plan invests in community violence and intervention. What we want to do is when we know we utilize trusted community members and encourage more community policing, we can intervene before the violence erupts. At least that's been the consensus in our experience. And community violence intervention programs have shown to reduce crime in some cities by up to 60%. Fourthly, our strategy to fund other vital services like mental health and substance abuse disorder programs, job training, and summer job programs.
President Biden earlier today at the White House, we talked about this topic this morning on Washington Journal with Politico's Daniel Lipman.
Yeah, so in that reconciliation package, basically who determines what's going to mean that is Senator Joe Manchin and Senator from West Virginia and Senator Kristen Sinema from Arizona. since they're the most moderate Democrats that Biden needs to pass that reconciliation package, because they don't want a huge liberal package. They want something a little bit more targeted. And so, you know, for a senator like Manchin, you know, West Virginia, I haven't checked the stats, but it's not a, there's not that many major cities which are, you know, bearing the brunt of this type of increase in violence, because it's a pretty rural state. And so he's under less pressure to, you know, put in more background check laws and to try to take illegal guns off the street. And so I'm sure that that reconciliation pact will have more funding for cops and, you know, making sure that they reform as well, because you don't want a repeat of where African-Americans in our country feel like the police are targeting them, you know, with George Floyd and countless other instances over the years. But I think they're trying to figure out exactly what's in that infrastructure package, how much money they should spend on childcare and other soft infrastructure, because they haven't, you know, finished that that infrastructure framework for the overall package. And so they're trying to kind of have the two things move at once, even though Biden has said that he's willing to sign just the hard infrastructure and you know, hasn't tied it as closely to the reconciliation package that he might do as well.
Well, I know you have a busy day and week ahead at the White House. Just quickly, can you run through the president's schedule? What other highlights are you looking at this week?
Well, he's meeting with Angela Merkel on Thursday. And, you know, this is Merkel's probably last trip to the White House. And, you know, it's something that he, you know, there's lots of stuff to discuss, including the, you know, the ongoing push by this administration to get Chinese influence stopped a little bit in Europe. You know, we need Germany on many different issues. Just looking through the schedule right now, in terms of the week ahead, on Tuesday, he's traveling to Philadelphia to deliver remarks on the right to vote. Democrats have, you know, kind of been disappointed a little bit by the White House in terms of not being able to pass those big vote protection and voter protection bills in Congress that, you know, to try to stop what's going on in Republican states in terms of making it harder to vote. And on Wednesday, he's meeting with a bipartisan group of mayors and governors to discuss that infrastructure package. And then on Thursday, when he also meets with Merkel, he is giving a speech about, you know, to mark the day that millions of families will get that first monthly tax relief payment thanks to the American Rescue Plan. And so it's a pretty busy week for Biden in Washington.
From this morning's Washington Journal, Daniel Lippman from Politico. You can see more from this morning's show at cspan.org/WJ. Last week, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer outlined his plans as Congress returns from its 4th of July recess. He said the Senate may work into August to pass both an infrastructure plan and a budget resolution that addresses child care and climate change. The Senate has not yet turned the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure framework into a bill. The plan includes $579 billion in new spending, with $300 billion for transportation and $250 billion for broadband power and water infrastructure. Here's the Senate Democratic leader earlier today on the Senate floor.
This upcoming work period will focus on exactly that, building a foundation for future American prosperity for years and decades to come through smart and bold investments in our nation's infrastructure. As I've said for weeks, the discussions about infrastructure legislation continue along two tracks. On the bipartisan track, our committees are getting closer to turning the recent agreement between the White House and bipartisan infrastructure group into legislation. I'm pleased to report we are making very good progress towards that goal. On the second track, the Senate Budget Committee is close to finalizing a budget resolution, which will allow the Senate to move forward with the remaining parts of the American Jobs and Families Plan. The Senate must pass the budget resolution and an eventual budget reconciliation bill with or without Republican support. The fact of the matter is, brick and mortar infrastructure is very important, but it's no longer the only type of infrastructure that matters in the 21st century. Human infrastructure, what many might call family support, as our families come under increasing pressure in this modern society. Things like childcare, family leave, education, health care are just as essential to giving our citizens opportunity as building roads and bridges and railways. Both are very important. 21st century investment in broadband internet, the electric grid, and retrofitting our economy to fight climate change in bold ways are just as important as roads and bridges and railways. We must do both. It's not one or the other, and we are going to do both. Before the week work period is over, it is my intention for the Senate to hold votes on the bipartisan infrastructure bill and a budget resolution. Members should prepare for a busier work period than usual, with the possibility of late-night votes, weekend votes, and changes to the August schedule. It's not going to be easy, but it's certainly going to be worth it.
Majority Leader Chuck Schumer earlier today on the Senate floor. According to the New York Times, Senator Schumer's goal is to, quote, simultaneously advance two hulking bills before the summer break, a bipartisan investment in roads, bridges, high-speed internet, and other infrastructure projects, and a far larger and more partisan package that would include tax increases on corporations and the rich to fund an expansion of the social safety net and programs to fight climate change. If successful, the July sprint would set up Congress to pass both bills into law when it returns to work in September. That's from the New York Times. Now, Tennessee Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn also talked about it today on the Senate floor.
It's July, and we still haven't seen a reasonable infrastructure proposal. No, instead, what we have is a truly insulting two-bill scheme that Senate Democrats concocted in lieu of a mandate for their radical environmental agenda. What will the American people get from this scheme? Well, just a fraction of what could be the largest spending initiative in history will go toward the roads, bridges, and broadband connections that people actually need and are willing to pay for. If Democrats want the more radical line items, they'll have to force it through by abusing the reconciliation process. In a sane world, this wouldn't even be a choice. They wouldn't do it because Democrats know that the kind of spending they're talking about will exacerbate inflation and increase the deficit. Meanwhile, Senate Democrats have all but ignored their duty to keep the country secure. In May, Customs and Border Protection caught more than 180,000 people trying to cross our southern border. Drug seizures were up 18% across the nation. As of the end of June this year, CBP has arrested more than 1 million migrants trying to come into this country. That is right. By the end of June, CBP has arrested more than 1 million migrants trying to come into the country. This is a vulnerability, and I would ask my Democratic colleagues and President Biden why they're not more concerned about it. I would also ask why they're not more concerned about the impending collapse in Afghanistan. The dominoes are falling.
Tennessee Republican Marsha Blackburn earlier today on the Senate floor. Remember, whenever the Senate is in session, you can find it on C-SPAN 2 and on the free C-SPAN radio app. According to the CDC's vaccine tracker, 159 million Americans are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus with either two shots of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines or one shot of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That equals 48% of the total population. On CBS This Morning Today, Dr. Anthony Fauci fielded questions from host Gayle King about the possible need for a COVID-19 booster shot.
Over the weekend, there was a bit of confusion between Pfizer and the CDC and the FDA. Pfizer says, listen, we need to get a booster shot. The FDA and the CDC say, no, not yet. Does Pfizer know something that the CDC and the FDA do not know?
No, not really, Gail. The situation is as follows. When you have a regulatory agency like FDA or a public health agency like the CDC, whenever they make solid official recommendations, they will do that based on solid data and evidence that they've gotten from clinical studies, which they are very actively accumulating right now and will utilize that data to ultimately make recommendations. What Pfizer did, understandably, they looked at what their data and they say, hey, you know, based on what we see, we think people should get vaccinated with a boost. Well, that's fine, except they're not the official recommending organization. So although they do good work, they have study and data that we will go over with them to determine if there's anything there that we need to use. But you're talking about the difference between an organization whose responsibility is to make an official recommendation based on data and a pharmaceutical company, as good as they are, who look at their product and say, hey, you know, we really think you need to get a booster shot. So all there right. is a difference there.
Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier today on CBS This Morning. And this from today's Washington Post. The Food and Drug Administration is planning to put a warning label on Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine that it's been linked to rare cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome. That's neurological disorder in which the body's own immune system mistakenly attacks part of its nervous system. The syndrome is rare and affects only about 3,000 to 6,000 people every year. The exact cause is not known, but most cases usually start a few days or weeks following a respiratory or gastrointestinal viral infection. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks for joining us. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 126. The NASDAQ up 31, and the S&P up 15. General Scott Miller, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, stepped down from his position today at a ceremony in Kabul, taking the United States a step closer to ending its 20-year war. The move came as Taliban insurgents continue to gain territory across the country. General Miller has served as America's top commander in Afghanistan since 2018. He handed over command to Marine General Frank McKinsey, the head of U.S. Central Command. He will operate from the CENTCOM headquarters in Tampa, Florida. The handover took place in the heavily fortified Resolute Support headquarters in the heart of Kabul at a time of rapid territorial gains by Taliban insurgents across Afghanistan. President Biden has said he wants U.S. forces out of the country by August 31st. Here is Pentagon spokesman John Kirby talking about the handoff earlier today at the Pentagon.
I do have two questions for you related to the transfer of authority from General Miller to General McKenzie. First one is, do General McKenzie's authorities to conduct airstrikes against the Taliban end on August 31st? And the second question is, when you mentioned that the airport security will be one of the four missions or purposes, what exactly, have you worked out what exactly U.S. troops would do at the airport? Will they be operating some sort of defensive weapon systems, or what will they be doing?
On your first question about authorities, what I can tell you is, as I said in my opening statement, that General McKenzie has all those authorities now, as did General Miller. So he possesses them now. I'm not going to speculate about timing on that. But what I can tell you is that certainly throughout the remainder of the summer, through the end of August, General McKenzie has those authorities. I won't go beyond that in terms of schedule or speculating about what it would look like going forward. On the airport, I think you know, Bob, we already have some and have had for quite some time some troops dedicated to security at the airport. There's an aviation support element there. There are some defensive capabilities. And I would expect that, without getting into details, to some degree and in some way, that support will continue through the drawdown. Now, what things look like after that, and after we've continued to flesh out all the details with Turkey, who has agreed to lead this security effort, we'll see. But what that looks like going forward after the drawdown. But through the drawdown, yes, we will have requisite capabilities there at the airport to assist in the security.
It's not clear that they would continue after August 3rd.
I don't want to get ahead of a decision-making process that's not complete. We are still in discussions with the Turks about what security at the airport is going to look like. We're grateful for their willingness to lead this effort. You heard President Erdogan talk about that last week. We're still hammering out, as President Erdogan said, we're still hammering out the scope of what that is. And as, when we get that all solidified, we'll be able to talk in more detail. But I don't want to speculate about a specific future presence at the airport for American forces just yet.
Follow up on the airport,
yeah,
I think.
Sure.
So I understand there's some kind of an agreement on a framework for the providing security for the airport by the Turkish side, but there's some, I guess, some sticking points. It's still under discussion. Are you able to highlight which issues are still being discussed with the Turkish side?
I don't. First of all, I would take issue with the description of sticking points. We've had some productive discussions with the Turks. We've been reading some of those calls out to you that the secretary has had himself with his counterpart. I don't believe I'd describe them as sticking points, but there are some modalities and some requirements that we're still working out with the Turks. And again, I don't think it would be useful for me to, publicly conduct a negotiation here at the podium. We're still talking with them. And when we have it more solidified, we'll be able to talk about it.
John Kirby speaking at the Pentagon to reporters earlier today. And from the State Department, there are renewed genocide allegations against China for repression of Uyghur Muslims and other minorities in northwest Xinjiang region. Here is Secretary of State Antony Blinken talking about it earlier today at the State Department.
All this work under both Democratic and Republican presidents with bipartisan support from Congress reflects our hope that with the right tools, resources, and commitment, we can ward off atrocities before they lead to mass human suffering. We want to change the story that we've seen play out too many times, that by the time senior policymakers are fully engaged, many people have died, the cost of taking action have risen, opportunities for early intervention have been missed. I say all this with humility, as someone who has served in senior levels of government before and has been in rooms when we grappled with what to do, when political unrest somewhere in the world gave way to mass violence toward civilians. This is an incredibly difficult challenge. My friend and colleague Samantha Power described it as a problem from hell. You'll recall her groundbreaking book on the subject. And we haven't cracked it yet. But we continue to believe that it's possible and that training, preparation, resources, cooperation within governments and among governments are key. And so, of course, is determination. This year, for the first time, the report provides direct, detailed accounts of atrocities taking place in specific countries, including Burma, Ethiopia, China, and Syria. These places represent some of the toughest foreign policy challenges on our agenda, and we'll keep working toward resolutions that reflect our commitment to human rights and democratic values. We'll use all of the tools at our disposal, including diplomacy, foreign assistance, investigations and fact-finding missions, financial tools and engagements, reports like this one, which raise awareness and allow us to generate coordinated international pressure and response in a whole-of-government approach to preventing and mitigating atrocities around the globe. At our best, the United States helps bring peace and stability to places where people are suffering. Our work on preventing atrocities represents our highest ideals in action, and the Biden-Harris administration will build upon the work of past administrations to bring us closer to a future in which atrocities are never allowed to happen again.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken earlier today at the State Department. The State Department report said the nation of Myanmar also remains a particular risk and added that the U.S. would continue to coordinate with allies and partners to press the military government there to halt all repression, including crackdowns on dissent that followed a coup in February, as well as the violence against the Rohingya. You can find the entire event on our website at cspan.org. In Cuba today, police patrolled the streets of Havana following rare protests against food shortages and high prices amid the coronavirus crisis. Cuba's president said the demonstrations were stirred up on social media by Cuban Americans. Many young people took part in the protests on Sunday, which disrupted traffic for several hours until police moved in. Cuba is going through a coronavirus surge and its worst economic crisis in decades as it suffers the consequences of U.S. sanctions imposed by the Trump administration. Today at the White House, President Biden addressed the Cuban protests, along with the recent assassination of the president of Haiti, before his gun violence roundtable discussion.
Folks, I want to start by recognizing the remarkable protests that are taking place in Cuba, with the Cuban people demanding their freedom from an authoritarian regime. And I don't think we've seen anything like this protest in a long, long time, if quite frankly ever. The United States stands firmly with the people of Cuba as they assert their universal rights. And we call on the government of Cuba, to refrain from violence and our attempts to silence the voice of the people of Cuba. And we're also closely following the developments in Haiti in the wake of the horrific assassination of the president that recently took place. The people of Haiti deserve peace and security, and Haiti's political leaders need to come together for the good of their country. Over the weekend, I dispatched a high-level expert delegation to assess the situation and to determine where the United States can offer our support. And finally, as a close neighbor and friend of the people of both Cuba and Haiti, the United States stands ready to continue to provide assistance, and I'll have more for you as we move on.
President Biden earlier today at the White House, the demonstrations in Havana and other communities around the country mark some of the biggest displays of anti-government sentiment in decades in Cuba. In Texas today, a group of Democratic members of the State House of Representatives left the state capitol in Austin on a pair of chartered flights bound for Washington, D.C., in an effort to block voting reform measures from advancing. The move would paralyze the chamber, stopping business until lawmakers return to the capitol or the session ends. Here is Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott yesterday on Fox News Sunday discussing the voting bills and the special session that was called.
On top of that, Barack Obama and the Biden administration, when they were in office, they came down to the state of Texas to send an FBI team as well as a U.S. attorney to investigate and to prosecute a voter fraud scheme where cocaine was being used to buy absentee ballots. I will tell you this also, Chris, and that is, even Democrats in the Texas House of Representatives, they agree that as it concerns mail-in ballots, that is an area where improving the mail-in ballot system is a way to achieve greater election integrity. So what Texas is doing is we're making it easier to vote by adding more hours of early voting than we had in current law, but also making it harder to cheat with regard to mail-in ballots.
Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott on Fox News Sunday yesterday. Don't forget, you can hear all of the network TV talk shows here on C-SPAN Radio beginning at 12 noon Eastern Time every Sunday. Voting rights was also the topic in Michigan today, where Vice President Kamala Harris held a listening session. She also commented on the situation in the Texas legislature.
I will say that they are leaders who are marching in the path that so many others before did, when they fought and many died for our right to vote. And I'll say this later in my comments, but I do believe that fighting for the right to vote is as American as apple pie. It is so fundamental to fighting for the principles of our democracy. So I applaud them, and it is with that spirit as well that we meet today. Over the past many weeks, I've been meeting with advocates and activists on the ground in places like South Carolina and in Georgia. Here, of course, in Michigan, again, I applaud the work that is happening in 2020. You had folks mask up and get to the streets to do what was necessary, to stand in line, to mail in ballots, to vote. And you turned out extraordinary numbers. And when people ask, well, why is my vote important? Well, we know the people here in Michigan voted because they said they wanted, on the issue of the pandemic, a national plan for vaccinations. They voted and they got that. The people of Michigan said, we're going to vote because we want more jobs. Well, they voted, and we have 3 million more jobs. The people of Michigan said, we're going to vote because we want to see children in America lifted out of poverty. They voted, and we got the child tax credit expanded so that we will lift half of America's children out of poverty.
Vice President Kamala Harris earlier today in Michigan. Just last week, the vice president announced a $25 million expansion of a Democratic National Committee campaign to boost voter registration and increase protections amidst efforts by Republican-led legislatures in multiple states to restrict voting access. A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it as a podcast at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.